Welcome back to the Animals at Home podcast. My name is Dylan Parent, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Today is a special episode because it is episode number 200 of the Animals at Home podcast. I have no idea how we got here. It really does feel like I've just started, but at the same time, it feels like I've been doing it forever. We've been doing it for nearly 6 years at this point. In the fall, it'll be 6 years, so it is really crazy that it's continued. I want to thank everybody who's listening, whether today is your very first episode. If that's the case, welcome to the podcast, or you're somebody that's been listening from day one. I am so grateful for all of you. I will tell you, there have been many times over the past 6 years where I thought maybe it's not worth doing or that I should stop. I mean, doing something every single week for 6 years is tiresome. There's no way around that. But you guys keep showing up and listening and watching the show and letting me know how much you appreciate it. So I can't stop now. I do really appreciate the support, like I said. And if you want to support the podcast even more, you can head to patreon.com/animalsathome. I'm so grateful for all the patrons. You guys do pay for the editing for the podcast. Without you, the podcast wouldn't happen. So if you want to help contribute to my time and my editing costs, that's the easiest way to do that. Many of you will have started noticing as well that I have taken your advice and started reaching out to sponsors. So over the next year or so, you'll start to see more. I think like-minded sponsors join the podcast and help fund the show. As fun as this is, it's a lot of work and it does cost money. And I do want to be able to make some money from it at the same time, because I do put so much time and effort into it. And if I wasn't doing this, I could be spending time with family and friends. But I do feel like this is very valuable, but I would like to turn it into a decently, I'm not trying to get rich, but having a bit of a revenue stream from this is very important. And you guys were all so agreeable to me bringing on sponsors that make sense for the show. So anyway, long story short, you'll see sponsors pop in if you haven't already, and I'm thankful for them as well. Let's jump into this episode today. Today I'm speaking with Rex Calubra, who I had back on the podcast, or I had on the podcast back in 2022. And in this episode, we discuss a couple of things. First, we discuss cohabbing and his experience with cohabbing, kind of linked to the episode we recorded with Liam and Ellie and Adam a couple weeks ago with the round table. Rex lays out the rules. Make sure you stay to the end of the podcast, because he lays out some really clean, concise rules for how to cohab successfully, something that he's been doing for basically 30 years without any issues. But he talks about where issues can come from and how to avoid those. But I think even more important than the cohabbing is the conversation we have about bonding with your reptiles and having this relationship with your reptiles. Rex has this uncanny ability to have relationships with the animals around him, including wild fish and raccoons and crows, but also the animals that he has in his home, his snakes. He has this incredible, almost like cat-like bond with them, like the way you would bond with a pet cat or a pet dog. And I think many people are afraid to have these conversations because they think it's getting too far outside the scientific realm. But I know there are people out there that feel like they have a relationship with their animal, that with their snake or reptile, that goes beyond the, you know, convention. And I hope this episode clears up some of those questions and makes you realize that you're not crazy. You probably actually do have a bond with your animal, and they probably do see you as a source of positive enrichment, however that looks on their end. We don't know, but there is at least something going on there. So anyway, I think I'm not going to say anything else. Let's jump into the episode again. Episode number 200. Thank you all for tuning in and listening to the show on a weekly basis. I cannot thank you enough. Enjoy this episode. Well, Rex, welcome back to the podcast. Thank you for being here again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I'm super excited. I mean, we stay in touch all the time. The episode that we recorded back, I think it was about 2 years ago around this time, so it's been about 2 years since you've been on the show, was one of those really popular episodes. It kind of took off on YouTube. People really loved the concept of just thinking about their pet reptiles in a different way and having more of a bond and a connection with them. So we'll get into that more. Do you want to just give everybody a quick kind of refresher of who you are, what you keep? You know, you don't have to go into the depth of your history with animals. That was on the last episode for the listeners. If you haven't heard that one, go back to it. But just maybe give us the Coles notes of who you are and how you got into keeping.
Well, I'm a keeper. I shouldn't say they're different, two different species. I've got two Brazilian rainbow boas, a male and female pair, and then I also have a male and female pair of Fog Island boas. And I've had them for, I think the oldest one is about 12, almost 13 years. And then the youngest one is about 7 years. And yeah, I've been kind of keeping pretty much my whole life. I've had large collections. I've had minimized down to small. Personally, I kind of like having a smaller collection just because I can be more intimate with the ones that I have a stronger connection with them. And I actually found that by doing that, you don't really get like the boredom that sometimes people get with the hobby, where like you feel like you need to buy another animal or something like that. It's more like, you know, it's an everyday process with each creature, or, you know, something along those lines.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think since the last time you came on, you actually went viral on TikTok and, you know, YouTube and all these different things with the story that you told on the podcast last time was the relationship that you built with a wild fish, a smallmouth bass. So I'll get you to explain that in a second, but you had told us the story, and then eventually, I guess it was found on, however the algorithm works on these things, eventually discovered it, and it kind of went wildfire. Can you tell us a little bit about that for people that have no idea what I'm talking about? I think this gives us a good indication of the type of person you are and the type of relationships you build with animals. And then tell us about the experience of what it was like to have something go viral.
Yeah, sure. So it's kind of funny, when we talked last, I had only gone on 3 dives with Elvis. I believe when we talked, it was the spring of 2022. Mm-hmm. And so I hadn't even met up with him yet for our 4th dive and our first spring reunion yet. I had just seen him those 3 initial dives. And then shortly after our interview, I ended up reconnecting with him for our 4th dive, which would be our very first spring reunion. And that year, 2022, we went on a total of 9 dives together. Excuse me. Pardon me. And we went on 9 dives together. And then the next year, it was another, I'm gonna say it was 22 dives, because it's been 34 in total. And so we went on another 22 dives last year. And in the early summer of last year, I had gotten the story picked up by the dodo, which is probably familiar with. It's an animal lover, animal, pretty big on YouTube and TikTok and all that. They picked up my story and they were really interested in it. And then I got contacted by a guy who said he was from a multimedia conglomerate company in Britain. And at first I kind of thought it was a scam. Just because the way it was worded, and I was just like, okay. And then I was like, well, hey, send me your LinkedIn and, you know, all your credentials and stuff, and I'll take a look at it. And he sent me his stuff, and I looked over it, everything checked out, and I was like, all right, you know, whatever, I'll give you an interview. I did like a 10-minute phone interview with him, and I sent him, I don't even think I sent him any videos or anything. I think he just took everything off of TikTok. But I signed all the, you know, information, all the waivers and stuff like that I needed to sign. And it was Friday that I did that interview. And Monday, I'm sitting around having breakfast, and a buddy of mine who's a nature photographer too, he goes, "Hey, dude, have you seen anything on the news lately?" And I was like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "You're all over the place." He's like, "What?" He's like, "Dude, check this out." And so he sent me a link with like a bunch of different news stories about the story of me and Elvis. And I was like, "No shit." It was all over the place. It was really cool. And it's been a wild ride.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, it is an interesting story. And for those that are unfamiliar with it and they want to see videos of it and whatnot, they can go to your page and check it out. And I mean, I remember even having reporters for the news contacting me through my Animals at Home Facebook account because we had done an episode together, and they were like trying desperately to get in contact with you. They're like, "Can you do anything to get the hold of Rex?" So it was a very compelling story. And then as far as updates, obviously we're now into another spring. So it is pretty amazing that you found him after a full spring, you know, ice on the water, come back, and then you reunite with him. I don't think the water's at the temperature yet for you to jump in, but I imagine that's getting pretty soon. So I assume you haven't had a 2024 swim with him yet.
No, not yet. It's still just a tad too cold. I was going to try again this week, but I'm not sure yet. The water lake is still like high 30s, low 40s. So that's pretty cold. So I'm not sure yet. And plus the thing is too, when the water's really cold, the fish aren't very lively. They're kind of in like a really lethargic state. And so as far as getting like good shots or, you know, good interactions, it's just not really the best.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, we'll be definitely watching to see when you do jump back in the water for this season. And I think everyone's fingers are crossed that you find him again. I'm sure you will, because it seems like he's, you know, he always knows where to find you. So that's a really interesting story. So let's jump into a little bit more about your snakes and the relationship you have with them. I do want to get into cohabbing and things like that we'll talk about later. But just for listeners, you do cohab all those boas together, the Hog Islands and the rainbow boas, which is an interesting thing. Can you walk us through the enclosures that you keep them in for those that missed the last episode, just to kind of give us a sense of how they're kept?
Yeah, absolutely. So I keep all four of the boas together in a large custom enclosure that I built. It is, it incorporates a closet, a small closet that I have. The closet size is 5 feet long. I want to say it's like just over 2 feet wide and then about 7 feet tall. And then I built a bump out that looks kind of like a stand-up shower stall. Outside of the room. So it extends the closet area out farther. So they have a total floor space of about, I want to say it's pretty close to 16 square feet, maybe a little bit more. And then it's 7 feet tall. So it's a pretty good size enclosure. To be honest with you, I actually wish it was bigger, and I would like to expand at some point, because they are all over this thing. It actually kind of feels too small. So I would like to eventually cut a hole in the wall and make a PVC tube and then build an enclosure on the adjacent wall. That would basically be like one big enclosure, but would be separated by the tube, or by the wall rather.
Mm. Yeah, that would be cool. And as far as how they interact with each other, I know that the Hog Islands, they seem to hang out together. They kind of have like a, you know, if you want to call it a friendship or a bond between each other. Do the rainbow boas interact at all with the Hog Island boas, or do they sort of stay separate?
They sleep together. They sit on each other, you know, crawl across each other. They're really not bothered whatsoever by each other. I've been keeping them all together since they've all been adults. I raised them up when they're younger in a smaller enclosure, obviously. Part of cohabbing is you never put a small snake with a large snake, just out of common sense. But so I've basically had them all together since they were adults. And I've been cohabbing since I was about 12 years old. I'm 40 now. And so I've really always had success with it, because I followed the rules. There's some certain key rules that you got to follow. I've pretty much never had any issues with them. The way they interact is very, very docile, very mild mannered. There's never any signs of aggression or stress. There's never any like kind of competition or anything like that. I mean, they're very, very passive. I don't know how to better describe it. It's just they're almost like kind of like two like old dogs that you've had forever and ever, where like, you know, the one doesn't even seem to phase the other. You know what I mean? Like they just kind of they're used to each other. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I mean, that's what you see on the posts that you make. And I would say you fall into the class of, I would say, unconventional reptile keeper, which allows you to have a very interesting relationship with them, because you're sort of bending the rules and going outside the box with a lot of things, which, you know, we talk about on the podcast all the time, how important it is if you are an in-tune keeper, how important it is to actually expand and experiment with your animals in a safe way. And that's, I think, exactly what you do. Maybe you could just quickly, because I'm sure people are thinking the eating situation when you feed them, just quickly run through that, and then we'll talk a little bit more about your bond and other aspects of their care.
Well, as far as feeding goes, part of the rules for cohabbing snakes is that you never feed separate days. So if it's feeding day, everybody's eating. And then I take them out of the enclosure, I feed them in a tub, or if it's nice outside, I'll take them outside and feed them in the grass, or I have kind of like a branch configuration thing that I've made that I let them climb on like a jungle gym. And so sometimes I'll feed them on that. But either way, I feed them separate outside of the enclosure. And then as soon as they're done, then I put them back in the enclosure. So that way there's never a hungry snake in the enclosure and then a snake that just ate and smells like a rat or, you know, prey item. And then I'm putting them back in so that they, you know, don't have any kind of interaction with that scent on them. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And that's another aspect of your care that I think you do on a fairly consistent basis in the summertime is you do a really good job of taking them outside.
Oh yeah. I love bringing them outside. They enjoy the sun, you know, fresh air. And I give them all sorts of like different things to climb on, different things to, you know, explore. I kind of have like this area in my yard where there's not a like trees or any like brush or cover, just, you know, mowed lawn. And I'll put the branch configuration up. I've got a couple of pork rounds that I'll bring, actually the ones from their enclosure. I'll bring them outside, put them down. Sometimes I'll pick like a handful of like leaves that are in the leaf pile, you know, nearby, and I'll kind of toss them in there, let them kind of crawl around in that. But yeah, for the most part, they absolutely love it. And actually, going back to something that you were just saying a second ago about the unconventional reptile keeping, it's funny because I grew up learning cohab from the guy that taught me reptiles. So, and he learned it from a guy that taught him. And so what my understanding of cohabbing is more of the norm. And now it's funny because, you know, in the recent years, I've been hearing all these people that, you know, freak out, oh, you can't keep them together. They're solitary animals and you're going to blah, 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 and all this and that. But I never had any issues. And it's literally the way I learned back when I first learned. So for me, cohabbing and, you know, the way I basically treat and care for my animals is, it's not controversial or it's not unconventional. To me, this is absolutely normal. This is how I've been doing it for decades now. And, you know, people can poo-poo all they want. There's always going to be haters. I'm sure people are going to come on the comments and say, oh, he's doing them a disservice and this, that, or whatever. But the reality is I've got four extremely healthy snakes. They don't miss meals. They sometimes breed. They all, you know, there's not a, well, I shouldn't say that. There's a scar on one of them, but there's, you know, there's barely any issues. And the scar that she got is actually not from interactions with the other snakes. It's because she rubbed her nose raw on a screen enclosure that I had her in. But yeah, I mean, I've never had any issues with the animals interacting with each other, mainly because I follow the rules. And I know you had, Adam Wicken from Wicked Reptiles on recently. And actually that was a really good episode. And he touched on a lot of the same things that I've been talking about for years. You know, you have to know your animals. You have to know the parameters that your animals are living in. You know, I mean, people might be like, oh, that's a strange island and Brazilian, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, they both are semi-arboreal. The Brazilians are semi-aquatic. They love the water. My hogs never soak. But yeah, I mean, they have a very similar kind of tropical habitat. And so as long as you offer, you know, a wide variety of different things for them to interact with, you know, and different, what's the word I'm looking for? Like different gradients of the environment. So like, you know, I have areas in the enclosure that are always humid, and I've got areas in the enclosure that are pretty much always dry. And so they get to choose where they want to go, you know, and it's the same thing with the UV area, you know, the UV basking area. They can choose to be under that light if they want to. They can certainly crawl away and do whatever they want. It gives them the option. Now, when I was younger, we didn't really know a lot about, you know, the UV and gradients and all that kind of stuff. It was more or less, you just had a hot side and a cool side. And that was pretty much it, you know, and it was a red poultry heat bulb, you know, so things have really progressed a lot. But I think one of the things is in nature, there's really not a static type of environment. And so if we can recreate that variance in their environment, in their habitat, I think that's actually doing them a service.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny how, like you said, people now, it's a pretty knee-jerk reaction to cohabbing. And back then, that was the total norm. So it's really just a perspective thing. As you know, you're looking at the hobby. Back then, it was a regular thing, so nobody would bat an eye. And now it's, you know, fairly aggressively talked against. And obviously, the answer is somewhere in the middle. We know that people have had cohabbing go totally awry. And maybe we can talk about you've mentioned some of the rules that you follow. We can talk about those as well, because I'd like to expand on that. But so that's where the sort of rule comes. You shouldn't cohab. People fail at it all the time, and then ends up in injury or death to the animal. Are there certain things that come to mind for you that you know for sure is a path to destruction when it comes to cohabbing? Like things, I think you've already mentioned some of them, but are there other ones as well that you think are very important for people to understand when they're trying to keep reptiles together?
Yeah, actually, I have a few horror stories if you want to hear them.
Sure.
With cohabbing that aren't my stories. So I knew a guy years ago, and he had a collection of carpet pythons, and he cohabbed them together. When he first got into the snakes, he was super into them. He did all the research, you know, he did this, that, or whatever, and he was very diligent on his care. And then over time, he just kind of lost interest. Right. He just kind of fell out of it. And I watched this guy neglect his animals. Now, I didn't, you know, I wasn't over at his house all the time. I had no, you know, real stay or contact, you know, no authority really. I was just an observer. And he starved his pythons to the point where one of them collided. He starved his snakes to the point where one of the pythons cannibalized the other two.
Wow.
So there was three carpet pythons together, and yeah, he just stopped feeding them for X amount of time. And then eventually it, you know, one thing led to another and got to eat. Right. So
right.
Yeah, it's kind of a dark story, but you know, it's one of those things. It's like, well, feed your animals and you won't really have to worry about that. So, I mean, that was kind of a dark story. I've seen people with, you know, injuries and stuff like that, that, you know, where they've kept their animals together. And a lot of it comes down to is, like Adam was talking about, is knowing your animal, like literally the individual that you're dealing with, as well as when you're introducing them, not just tossing them in and walking away. You know, you have to introduce them very slowly, and you really have to be super observant the first few weeks, few whatever, you know, for a certain amount of time. You have to be super observant to see how these animals are reacting to each other, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, right? And so if you're not paying attention and you just toss these animals together, or, you know, you're starving them, or you feed one of them, you don't feed the other. I mean, there's all sorts of different things that can go wrong. But I've unfortunately seen some of the darker sides of cohabbing. But the thing is, though, is that that same person, you know, also had other issues with neglect of other animals. You know what I mean? Because
right.
They got into it, and then they fell out of it, you know, fell out of interest. And I think that's a whole nother discussion. You know, is why are we getting animals to satisfy a curiosity? And then when that curiosity is gone, all of a sudden they're kind of a burden.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And
yes.
I know this is kind of sad. People don't want to talk about this, but it's true. And I've seen it so much over the years where people will, you know, buy a corn snake, buy a ball python, buy a whatever. And then 6 months later, they hit me up and like, hey, do you want this snake? And I'm like, dude, you just bought that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are you talking about? And they're like, oh, well, you know, and there's always some excuse, but it's like, you know, if you're not committed to it, why did you get it? You know? And so I think what we really should do as individuals is we should do soul searching and think, is this something that I want long-term? Or is this something that I'm interested in right now?
Yes. Yeah. And that's a great point about just commitment in general, where cohabbing is not for everybody. This is not a promotion that everybody should do it, but it's just definitely something that can be done if you are a committed keeper. So if you're somebody who you might even be a committed keeper, but don't have the time to spend like 6 weeks making sure things don't go or things go well, then it's not for you. But it, I think that is, that could be a danger of people wanting to cohab, is it could fulfill that curiosity just for a couple of months, like let's see what happens when I keep these animals together, and then kind of forget about it, and then things might go awry if you're not paying attention. So it really is for the person who is in tune with their animals, paying attention to the each characteristic and each personality of the animals that they're putting into an environment together. And if they actually somehow start to fall out of curiosity and out of love working with that setup, then it's something that you need to reverse out of. Because you need to, and until, I mean, I imagine you're not intently watching your boa enclosure all the time because they've been kept that way for so long, but you need to be honest with yourself as a keeper that if you're hitting a point where you don't have the time, energy, or interest in making sure that the situation is under control, then you should not attempt to keep animals together in the same enclosure.
Oh, totally. Absolutely. And another thing too is that there's nothing that says you have to put them together and then they have to stay together. Like, I think the best thing to do is an introductory period. So that may be something as simple as, you know, you reset the enclosure so that it's new for everybody. And we're talking about snakes here. This is, you know, lizards and other things. There's different nuances to them because some lizards can be territorial. Some creatures can be territorial. Snakes generally are not territorial from everything that I've experienced. I could be wrong. There's probably some species out there that is, right? But as a general rule, they're not. And so when I reintroduce, or I'm sorry, when I introduce the snakes, a lot of times what I'll do is I will reset the enclosure, kind of move stuff around, and then I'll put all the animals back in there and then the new one. And then what I'll do is I'll just kind of watch and see, you know, how they act. Are they smelling them? Or her, are they investigating? Are they leaving them alone? What's happening? And then I can always take that animal out, put it back in its other enclosure, and then come back later, you know, next day and try it again for another 20 minutes. You know what I mean? There's nothing that says I have to toss that animal in there and then it's over with, you know? I think an introductory period is actually super important for really introducing any animal, whether that's a dog and a cat, you know, I mean, shit, even a dog and a kit, you know, there needs to be that getting to know you period.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of the other species, you know, obviously you cohab the snakes together, but can you tell us a little bit about some of the other cohab experiences or the species that you've kept together over the years? As you said, this is something that you've been doing basically your whole reptile keeping career.
Yeah. So I've had turtles before that I've cohabbed. The species that I had was Eastern Painted Turtle, a Mississippi Map Turtle, and then I had a Razorback Musk Turtle that all lived together. And then at one point I did have a three-stripe mud turtle, but she actually died. But they all lived in the same enclosure together. So turtles can actually kind of be a little territorial. And same with lizards. So when I was talking about resetting the enclosure for the snakes, that's actually more important to do with lizards and turtles. I have very little experience with crocodilians, so I really couldn't tell you anything about cohabiting them. But when it comes to snakes and turtles, if you rearrange the environment, when you put them back in there, it's new to everybody, right? Not just the newcomer, right? So if I reset everything, the turtles that did live in there have to relearn and map out the enclosure the way I just set it up. So when I put the new turtle in there, they're all new. And so to them, it's like there is no territory. You know what I mean? And yes. So a lot of times what they'll do is they'll be bumbling around the enclosure, you know, checking out all the rocks and the this and the that. And, you know, you'll see them come face to face. Sometimes one will shy away. Sometimes they'll do like the little nose to nose. But yeah, I mean, you can cohab a lot of things. It comes down to, again, knowing the animal, making sure that you have the right type of setup for them. Like, obviously, you don't want to put a desert tortoise in with, you know, a creature that needs 100% humidity. You know what I mean? It's just not going to work out. So knowing the environment that your animal comes from and its needs are super important. But as far as like cohabbing lizards, I've cohabbed geckos before. I've cohabbed geckos and anoles. I had a savanna monitor with a green iguana. And it's really just all about making sure that you're watching them and that, you know, they are, you know, you kind of have to become an animal behaviorist. You know, you have to watch their behaviors and see the way that they're interacting with each other and the environment. If one animal seems stressed out, and is hiding, refuses to eat, you know, its colors are pale and it doesn't seem vibrant anymore. I mean, that's a clear sign that it's not happy, right? I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. So in that kind of situation, yes, take that animal out of it, right? That's not working out. But if the animals are showing all signs of being healthy, if they're eating, if their colors are vibrant, if their activity seems normal, I mean, what's the harm? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think it's also funny too, because the people that seem to rail against cohabbing are never the people that are doing it successfully.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like, you've never tried cohabbing, but please talk crap about me and how I'm doing it successfully. But
yeah, exactly. Well, and because it goes back to those old myths, and I imagine enclosure size is also very important. Do you have like a rule of thumb or anything that you use as far as enclosure size? I assume if you have one species that would be kept in X size enclosure, you don't just dump more species into that same size enclosure. I'm sure there's an expansion. Who knows? You know, I'm sure you don't have an exact number, but is a large enclosure important size to you when you're cohabbing animals?
Yeah, I would definitely say that's a huge factor. You know, I honestly, this is a lot of people are probably going to not like my opinion on this, but I really think that the majority of reptiles kept, at least in the United States, and from what I've seen, are kept in extreme confinement. And by that, I mean, when you have a 4.5-5 foot boa in a 4x2x2, that is extreme confinement. That is not an adequate size. It's really not. And people say, oh, well, it's as long as the snake is, it can stretch out. But you're talking about animals that have evolved to climb trees. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Their whole home is this, right? They wander around, they search all over the place. But we get this idea that as long as it's as long as they are, right? If it's a 4 foot snake, put it in a 4 foot enclosure. We get this idea that if it's as big as the enclosure, or the animal is as big as the enclosure, that it's somehow okay. But that would never fly with a horse or a dog or a parrot. Or, I mean, think of any animal that if I said, hey, that enclosure is the size of that horse. You know what I mean?
Like, yes. Yeah.
Nobody would be cool with that. If I kept the horse in a box and never let it out, I mean, which is what a lot of people do. A lot of people get reptiles and then they just keep it in the box, which everyone's free to do whatever they want to do, right? I'm not here to tell or judge anybody, but if we're being honest with ourselves, like we should be, a lot of what we're offering these animals is really just not sufficient. I have what a lot of people consider too big of an enclosure for mine, and they use every inch of that. Mm-hmm. And like I said earlier, I kind of think that it's too small. I think that I should actually go bigger for them. Now, when you're talking about having multiple animals together, having a large enclosure is a must, because if they want to be able to be away from the others, they need to be able to retreat. I'm actually kind of also wandering through here hoping that I find a snapping turtle in this, but some impromptu herping. But yeah, having the proper size enclosure for multiple animals so that they can retreat and have private time, you know, it's actually really important. And so if they can, I found somebody's cell phone. How about that?
Oh, look at that.
I should probably bring that with, so it's not out here in the woods. But, look, there's all these frogs in here. I bet you they're going to lay eggs.
Oh, yeah, that's prime egg-laying location.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is like just a stopped puddle right here. And there's all sorts of tadpoles in it. That's awesome. But, yeah, getting back to it, though, the size of the enclosure for multiple snakes or multiple reptiles it's super important. Like I said, they got to be able to move around and exercise while also not disturbing each other and being able to have separate hides. I've got multiple hides in mine. You know, I've got four snakes. I've got more than four hides. So that way each snake has a spot to hide, you know, hang out, got branches for them to climb on, fake plants to hide among. So, yeah, I mean, going back to it, I think that we're doing these animals a disservice by not having larger enclosures. And that's kind of one of the things that I like about having smaller boas versus large ones. When I was a kid, I grew up having Burmese pythons. Mm-hmm. And I mean, some of them were freaking huge. And it's just, they are not a practical snake for most people in the hobby.
If you are interested in supporting the podcast and simultaneously supporting the welfare of your reptile at home, make sure you check out Custom Reptile Habitats for their premium enclosures. You can find an affiliate link in both the YouTube description or the show notes, or just head to animalsathome.ca/CRH. If you use that link and head to their website to make a purchase, a commission comes back to me at no extra cost to you. And of course, that helps me support the show. Alternatively, you can join us over on Patreon at patreon.com/animalsathome. For as little as 75 cents per episode, you can support the podcast and you will automatically be entered into the Discord server so you can have conversations with like-minded keepers. If you do bump yourself up to the $5 per month tier, you will have early access to episodes and the opportunity to submit questions to upcoming guests. Yeah, absolutely. And I think too, I think as you say, most animals are confined into something that's probably too small. I think you can get away with it provided you have, like you do, take your snakes outside, get them some exercise, maybe have a play area, quote unquote play area in your home or in a room that's snake proof or animal proof that you can let them out and get their exercise. So I think you could potentially get away with a smaller enclosure if that is something that you're offering on a weekly basis. But if you are cohabbing, I don't think you can make that consideration just because the space within the enclosure is so crucial. I mean, this is not advocating for smaller enclosures, but in the cohab setting, you certainly can't just say because I have a play area or I'm taking them outside on a weekly basis that I can get away with a smaller space for them.
Right, totally. And, you know, I'm not going to say that I'm a saint by any means. In fact, when I moved into the house that I'm at now, I had probably, it was probably close to like 6 to 9 months of transition where I didn't have my boa enclosure built and I had all of them stuffed into a small enclosure for a short time. I felt terrible, dude. I felt so bad because when I moved, I took them out of the big enclosure and then put them in the small thing, but then eventually built one that's been the biggest that they've ever had. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I did feel bad for those 6 to 9 months when they were cramped up. But, you know, the thing is that I feel like at least I was able to offer them something that was, you know, 3-4 times the size of the other enclosures. You know what I mean? Right. So maybe that 6 months did suck, but at least now, you know, it's been 3 years now that they've been in the big enclosure and I doubt that they even remember the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think there's an interesting side to this conversation as well, is the benefit to the animal. Because I think some people will say, well, if you're cohabbing, you're really just doing it out of your own convenience or your own interest. But I wonder from your perspective, someone who has cohabbed for decades, and especially in the current situation with the boas, do you feel, and I know that there'll be some scientific-minded people out there that will not agree with analyzing a situation just from our own anecdotal thoughts, but do you feel that it's beneficial to the snakes to keep them together, or is this just something that's merely interesting for you to do?
Well, here's the thing. So I think that it's multifaceted, like everything in this world. First off, yes, it is. Of course, it's easy for me. It's one big enclosure that I have to clean instead of four big enclosures. Because realistically, I shouldn't be offering my 6.5 foot Brazilian rainbow boa anything smaller than what I have around now, in my opinion. All this trash really makes me so sad. Anyway, but as far as, you know, them, what kind of benefit they're getting? Well, A, they've got a nice large enclosure that they have more room than what, you know, would have been offered if they were by themselves in most cases. But also, you know, one of the things too, is people think that, you know, snakes are solitary, you know, they hate, you know, other snakes. They hate even their own kind. They'll never rest with each other. But dude, I've seen all sorts of herping videos, including like some of the Dave Kaufman videos where he's finding retics that are, you know, huddled up together and stuff. I've found multiple snakes myself that have been laying together, you know, curled up underneath a log or a sheet of tin. I've even seen, believe it or not, I've even seen videos of king snake laying with a coach whip. I mean, a snake eating snake laying with, you know, essentially his prey, and he wasn't trying to, you know, eat him. So, I mean, the thing is, they do rest together. They do come across each other. Now, you know, I think we kind of have, at least in our culture, I think we kind of have a skewed idea of how nature works. I've spent a lot of time in the woods and just in nature with animals and stuff. And I can tell you that our idea is that animals are constantly preying on each other, right? Like the squirrel doesn't have any chance to rest because there's always a hawk trying to get him, or there's always a wolf or a coyote coming after that deer. They have no chance to rest. They've got, you know, this constantly fight or flight. But this is what you're looking at most of the time. It's just calm. And everything is just calm. And yeah, there's predators that prey on things because they need to eat, but they're not like us. They don't overhunt. They take what they need, and if the opportunity is there, they'll go for it. But it's not this vicious, constant fighting. It's not a constant battle that everything is waging. Because if that was the case, think about it. I mean, nothing would be able to survive. You know what I mean? Everything would be stressed to death. You know what I mean? If you lived in a bad neighborhood, I mean, think of how many of those people are just super stressed out of their mind because they have to deal with dangerous situations at any turn, right? And so, yeah, animals are on alert for danger. Especially if you watch some of the videos of me and my raccoons, the raccoons are very much on high alert. You know, even when they're hanging out with me, which is a place of relative safety, I mean, other predators aren't going to walk up while I'm feeding them, but, you know, they're very on high alert, but at the same time though, they're not living in a constant state of fear. And I think that's kind of a big thing. And so when we're cohabbing snakes, when we're talking about cohabbing snakes or cohabbing any animal, we got to take into consideration that the majority of an animal's life is a state of peace, is a state of just chill or exploration or intrigue, you know, trying to figure out what's going on around you. But it's not this constant perpetual drip of adrenaline and fear. And you know what I mean? So when we're talking about putting them together and having them together, I mean, like I said before, at the beginning of this, they basically just kind of don't bother each other. Like one will crawl across the top of the other and there's no signs of aggression or stress. You know, they're not breathing heavy. They're not recoiling back, you know, in fear or anything like that. So, I mean, I don't know. Is there a benefit to having them together as far as like social interaction? Now, I have actually seen my boas interacting with each other, particularly the same species. I don't really see it much in the others, but I'll see it sometimes where Mojo, my male Hog Island, will do these things where he'll like flick his tongue on my female's head as if he's like smelling her head. I don't know why he does it, but he does it sometimes. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't seem bothered by it. And I don't know what the social interaction is there as far as what that means to them. I couldn't tell you, and I'm not about to project. But it's definitely there. It's something that I've observed. And what else is really interesting is that Mojo, my little male hog island, and Pepper, my female hog island, are they have a very strange relationship. So they rest together a lot, probably about 70 to 80% of the time they're together. And what's really cool is I've seen times where Pepper will crawl to a different spot, like say she's underneath a cork round or on a ledge or something, and I watch her crawl up to say like the branches up high, and Mojo will follow her and then coil right up there with her. So what that's all about, again, I couldn't tell you, but there's something there. Now, whether or not this is beneficial to the animals, their mental well-being or whatever, I couldn't tell you. But there's definitely no stress. And yeah, that's the big thing. Because if they were stressed, I definitely would not do this. And I would not recommend anybody doing this.
Well, and that's a really good point, actually. I think you're so right about how we perceive nature, as we perceive it as this constant battle and these animals that have incredibly high like cortisol spikes all the time because they're running for their life. And really, just like humans, if you are operating like that, you become sick and die quite soon. You can't really operate in flight or fight all the time. It's absolutely something that comes in waves and goes. And I think that's a really good point. And we actually have the ability to recognize stress and anxiety and fear in our animals fairly easy. As long as you're, again, in tune with your animals. If you know your animal, you know what it looks like when they're scared and you know, like you said, coiling up or breathing heavy or there's so many different body language behaviors that if they're not exhibiting, you know that the snake isn't trying to hide the fact that they are stressed by looking like they're relaxed. You know, that's just not... that's not how animals operate. They're
right.
They're going to go off food. They're going to pace. They're going to do all those things that you see in a stressed animal. So provided those things aren't happening, I think it's safe to assume that there isn't stress happening.
Right.
The other thing...
I would definitely agree with that. And that's... oh, go ahead.
I was just going to branch off into your relationship with your animals themselves. I mean, you've already mentioned, we talked about Elvis the fish, which is a wild fish for those of that. I know we talked about it, but for those who haven't seen the videos, he is a wild fish that goes and finds Rex. And it's a clear, I don't know how you would define that relationship, but there is some sort of relationship there. This fish finds you, it swims around you. It's, you know, it's bizarre to say the least, but you have this relationship with them. And you talked about the raccoons, and I feel like there was some crows involved in your life for a while as well. And so I'll let you... go ahead. Maybe you could tell us quickly about the raccoons and the crows, and then I want to get into like the bond that you have with your snakes themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have unwittingly befriended the neighborhood raccoon, and it actually all started off because of the crows. So back in 2021, maybe it was, or 2022, I forget, but, I started feeding some local crows in my neighborhood, and, they started coming around every day. I taught them a whistle that I do, and now they fly in every morning. Usually they wake me up, sit there in the trees, calling for me first thing in the morning, which is actually really cool. And then I'll get up and go and say hi to them. And I do like a little whistle and make these little sounds and stuff and talk to them a little bit. And, you know, we have our little relationship with the crows. But then I had the idea that, hey, what if I built like a cool crow feeder, special bird feeder just for the crows, and I'll hang it on the tree and it'll be this cool thing. Well, I had built this crow feeder. I put it on the tree. And they never used it. They were like scared of it or something. So they never used it. But the food kept disappearing, right? Like I put dog food and peanuts up there and the food kept disappearing. So I was like, all right, well, something's up here eating the dog food. I know the squirrels are eating the peanuts. And So one night I come out to water the plant, and for some reason my hose was busted or whatever, and I use buckets to carry the water, plus it's a good workout. And so I'm carrying buckets of water outside, and it's twilight. The sun's gone down and it's twilight. It's getting dark. And I hear some scratching on the bark on the tree in the corner. And so I look over and I'm like, I could barely see it. And I see this big raccoon on the ground that was like trying to take off, but you could tell she was hesitating. And then I hear the scratching on the bark of the tree, and I look up and there's four baby raccoons in my crow feed eating the dog food. So I go back inside. I set the buckets down real quiet, and I back up and I walk inside, and I grab some more dog food and I walked out, and I stayed a good distance from them because I didn't want to scare them away. But I just started talking to them and tossing the dog food out, and they climbed down the tree. Mom didn't run off. Mom hung out, and they climbed down the tree. They ate. They kept the distance. Right. Like the first couple nights, it was like, you know, 15 feet, no closer. Right. And then after a little while, a couple more nights, they started coming in closer. And then finally, I don't even remember how long it had been, but finally at one point I've got all four babies surrounding me, sniffing me, taking food from my hands. And mom is like 10 feet away, laying in the grass, eating food, not even facing.
Wow.
And so that's pretty cool. And what's even more cool is that so one of the babies from that original batch grew up to have babies last year. And since she was already comfortable with me, she brought her babies right up to me right away. And since the babies were like, okay, well, mom's cool with him, you know, clearly this guy is cool and he's offering us some really good food. I mean, maybe he's not so bad. And So I befriended those ones, and one of them has stuck around. I haven't seen the other one. I don't know what happened to that one. The one has stuck around. I named her Baloo, and I'm pretty sure it's a female. But she is just so sweet. She takes food from my hands. She lets me pet her. I can rub her paws. I can give her chest scratches. She defends me from other raccoons. Mostly after she's defending the food, but she doesn't like it when the raccoons are close. Yeah, it's just really cool. But she'll hang out with me, eat, you know, until she's full, and then she wanders off and goes about her little raccoony day.
Yeah, that is amazing. I mean, having a relationship with a wild animal is kind of taking it to the next level. And I think it speaks to how patient you are and how open you are with animals. I know this gets into like weird territory for some people, but there is an energy that people give off. And if you have a calm energy that's not aggressive or not threatening, you're much more likely to have, you know, build those relationships with whether it's wild animals or captive animals. And I think some of the videos on your Instagram that get the most popularity is just you showing the reactions or the interactions you have with your snakes, just putting your hands out and them clearly coming to you and investigating you. And it's this real calm process. And I think those types of videos actually capture a lot of non-reptile people because they're sort of surprised that a snake may actually want an interaction with a human, which again, I know we're not talking about cats and dogs. It's not the same as a cat and a dog, but there's something there. I mean, maybe you could speak to it. Like, how would you define that relationship that you have with your snakes? Is it akin to like you would have with your cat, or what are some of the differences?
You know, dude. Oh man, that's such a big question. I love it. Yeah. So okay, to start off with, I think when it comes to the attitude part, and just kind of the interactions that I have with them, most people from my experience and from what I've seen, and you can read any comment section under any video about animals and you can see it yourself, is that most people live in a state of fear and anxiety towards animals and nature in general. And that fear and that anxiety is a barrier. It immediately puts up a wall. Now, think about when you're talking to a human or you're interacting with a human. If you're afraid of that person, right? If you're like genuinely terrified that person's going to flip out and, you know, beat your ass for no reason, like, what do you think that's going to do to the vibe? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, is that person going to like feel like you're being friendly and that you're worth hanging out with? Or is that person going to be like, maybe I should take off because this guy's weird? You know what I mean? And so I know I'm talking about humans here, but it's very much the same with animals. And then, you know, there's the whole cliche, animals can smell fear and, you know, yeah, they can sense fear, but it's true. They can just as much as we can, right? We can sense when somebody's fearful. I can sense when a dog is fearful, right? You can see it. You can, everybody knows it. Like, body language is kind of a universal thing.
Absolutely.
Right? And so, when we're talking about dealing with animals, whether it's a wild animal or your pet or someone else's pet, right? Having that calm, collected, patient, relaxed demeanor is going to open up so many doors that have been closed to you because fear and anxiety. And I really cannot stress that enough because that's all I'm doing. People, like, I get people comment, oh, this is miraculous, or you're special, but I'm not. I'm really not. I'm just a dude, right? Like, I don't know magic. I don't have any spells. All I'm doing is I'm treating these animals as if they deserve respect and that they are their own little being, right? Like, when I look at someone's dog or my dog, that's my little buddy, right? Like, that's in a dog body. Right. And we all know that. That's, I mean, I don't even have to argue, but it's the same thing with everything else. And if we can detach from that fear state and embrace courage and love, dude, I'm telling you, you can pretty much befriend anything. Mm-hmm. It's really that simple. I forgot what the second part of your question was.
Oh, and just, I mean, I think that was really well said. And I just how you perceive your relationship with your snakes, like, do you feel, is it similar to like how you act or interact with your cats and dogs? I know, I assume like the starting premise of being calm and relaxed is, but I don't even know if this is a question or not. I'm just trying to wonder, like, how does it feel to, because for the listeners that haven't seen your videos, essentially when you go up to the snake enclosures, a lot of times it's like the snakes come out to see you. And like you said, I'm not surprised people say this is miraculous or that you're like a snake whisperer or something, but they seem to have a connection with you that goes far beyond what most people would have with their snakes because they're not spending that time interacting with them. And I'm just wondering, how does it feel from your end?
Well, as far as how it feels amazing. I mean, watching an animal that most people just automatically write off as being stupid or unable to bond with humans or unable to bond with anything, right? Which is basically what all people assume about reptiles, fish, you know, the quote unquote lower animals. But being able to form a bond with them to the point where I can stick my hand into the cage while they're resting, and I can have Mojo just start crawling right into my arm, right? That is a rewarding feeling that money can never buy. As far as what I think our relationship is, here's the thing. So when you're talking about a cat, right, and the way you interact with a cat, and you're talking about a dog and the way you interact with a dog, it's two separate things, right? Dogs like to be pet a certain way. They like to be interacted with a certain way. It's the opposite with cats, or different with cats, usually, right? Mm-hmm. If I pet my cat the way I pet my dog, she'd go running, right? And so knowing that you have to have a different set of procedures or a different set of rules about how you engage with this animal, knowing that you have to do that, that sets you up to understand that they're all pretty much the same. It's just how you reach them, right? How do I reach a boa and get him to want to interact with me, right? How do I reach a cat? And this is another thing too that I find funny is that people will be like, why don't you get a normal pet, like a dog or a cat? Well, it's like, what's normal about a dog or a cat? I mean, have you ever seen a feral cat or dog? They don't want to come near you. I've got feral cats that come to my backyard, or my front yard, where I feed my raccoons, and the raccoons will come right up to me, but I've been out there for years now and I cannot get these cats to come up to me, right? Like, they're scared. And the thing is, you know what I mean? That fear is what blocks them from wanting to bond with me. And now extrapolate that to, or, you know, take a step back and look at your house cat. What makes that house cat happy to see you, want to rub on you, want you to pet it, right? Versus that stray cat, that feral cat that won't even let you 50 feet near it. What's the difference? Difference is how you interacted with it.
Yeah, the connection you have with it. How exactly?
Absolutely. So if I have a snake and the only thing that snake knows is I reach in and throw food in, or I pull that animal out, I set it on the ground, and then I clean its cage and then I put it back in, that's all it's going to know of me. That's our relationship, if that's the case, right? But if I'm interacting with the animal, if I take it out, a lot of people ask me actually how I started my interactions with my animal. It's actually just as simple as when they were babies, I took them out and I sat on a couch with them, just sit them on my lap. And at first they're going to be scared because it's a new scary thing. But after a while they learn that you're not going to hurt them. And once they realize that you're not going to hurt them and that you've established the fact that you're never going to hurt them and you don't break that trust, they will trust you. And that's another thing that's interesting too, is because I get a lot of people that, actually I just did a live stream last night with my raccoons, and I had one guy go, scare it in the comments. And I said, why would I do that? He goes, to see if it attacks you. I'm like, yeah, but that's literally breaking the trust. You know what I mean? That's breaking the trust that I've built up with this animal for how long? Like, why, yeah, exactly. Why would I do that? You know what I mean? But some people don't understand that, like, you know what I mean? If you're consistent with being cool with them, right? Like I've always been cool with the raccoons. I've never done anything to try to freak them out or scare them or cross boundaries. And so in return, they don't do anything to me, right? Like I've given them no reason to bite.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? Because like people get bit because they got bit for a reason. Either the animal was afraid, or you were in its territory and it felt that you were some kind of a threat to its, you know, females or whatever, or it was hungry in the case of a predator. Right. But I mean, realistically, there's not a lot of predators that prey on humans.
Yeah.
So most times when we're talking about an attack or a bite, it's because the person did something stupid to make the animal feel scared enough that it felt that it had to defend itself.
Right. Well, I think that's a really good way of thinking about it too, is just analyzing what your relationship is with the reptiles that you have. And instead of thinking about, yeah, I offer great care, I have the lighting, all these different things, offer, you know, enrichment. But what is your actual interaction? Like, what's the interface between you and that animal? Is it just very utilitarian? Like, you're feeding, you're watering, you're moving them around when needed. And if that's it, then that's the picture that they have of you. And it's nothing more than that. And in many ways, that animal eventually learns that this is not a distressful thing. It's just that the big, large mammal comes and does some tasks in its enclosure, and then it disappears and it's nothing to worry about. But it can be so much more than that, and it can be far more expanded if you do, you know, interact with them on that kind of regular basis. And I think it opens up a totally different relationship you can have with a snake, for example, which is just something that many people just don't think is possible.
Right. Well, absolutely. And that's the thing is when it comes to dealing with an animal, no matter what kind it is, what you get or what you give is what you get. So your level of involvement, your level of commitment is going to equal what you get out of it. You know, I have chose to make myself a part of my snake's lives, right? All four of them know me very well, and I know them. And we interact very regularly, right? Like, they all just got done eating, and so they're full and they're lethargic and laying around right now. But as soon as that wears off a little bit, you know, we'll be right back at it. And so the thing is, if you're the type of person that, you know, you're too busy or you just don't care, well, then, yeah, of course you're not going to form a bond with them. Of course they're not going to form a bond with you, right? Because one hand washes the other. It goes two ways.
Yeah.
You can't expect to have a friend when you don't do anything to reach out to that person or, you know, or that other being, say.
How do you think they know you?
It's all about your level.
How do you think they know you? Do you think they know you from mostly scent, or do you think they're actually, I mean, every species of reptile is going to be totally different. You're dealing with different types of, you know, ability to smell and perceive the environment that way or visualize the environment. But for the boa specifically, do they recognize you visually, or do you think they don't recognize you until they actually like smell your hand, for example?
Actually, that's a great question. I can tell you that they know, it would be mostly scent based as far as the recognition of who you are as an individual, but they can definitely see me walking around like my room, or if somebody else walks in the room, they know. And what's really interesting is, so when I wake up in the morning, my snake cage is in my office. And so a lot of times in the morning, the first thing I'll do is I'll go in there and check on them. And I spray them with a Hudson sprayer. I do it by hand. I mean, I kind of want to get a misting system, but I like the idea of doing it by hand because it just feels more like I'm engaging with them.
Yeah.
But so part of my morning ritual is I go in there and spray them. Well, Mojo thinks that when I go in that room, it's time to come out. So if I go in there and grab the sprayer, if he's resting, a lot of times he just immediately comes to the door and is like, it's time. Oh, he's here. It's, you know, it's time to hang out. And if it's a day that I don't have to work, yeah, you know, I'll take him out. I'll put him on the couch. We'll hang out, or, you know, maybe go outside or do whatever. But I mean, I could set a clock to it. I mean, he does that every morning. My rainbows, because rainbows are a lot more nocturnal, they like to choose to come out when it's dark. So when the lights go off and, you know, it's nighttime and stuff, that's when they come to the glass, to ask, quote unquote, to come out. But, my Hog Islands will do it any time of the day. If they see me in the room, they came on. And it's actually really kind of endearing. Like, I walk in the room, they're like, hey, take me out.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So, but yeah.
And I also think like this is where they must recognize you is if, let's say you take them outside and let's say it's a feeding day and you happen to be feeding them outside as well. Clearly at the end of that situation, you have to pick them up and bring them back inside in some capacity. I wouldn't even think about touching my boas after they've eaten a meal because I know they would bite me. Like I just feel like they're in such a feeding mode. They're going after anything that's warm and moving, and it takes them like a good hour or two after taking the meal to like bring it down. If once you've fed, like let's say Mojo, for example, is he like, if he smells your hand, is he not going to go after it as like a food mode situation?
No, actually, believe it or not, man, they, is the minute I pick them up, like, so if I feed them outside or if I feed them in the tub, usually I do grab the snake hook to get underneath them and get just part of their body up. But for some reason, the second I get them like up off the ground, like start lifting them, it breaks them out of that food mode, like out of feeding mode. I don't know how it works, but for some reason, as soon as I pick them up, they're like, okay, I'm up. You know what I mean?
Interesting.
Yeah. So I don't know how that works, but it's always been like that for me. As soon as I'm done feeding the snake, I just, you know, I slide the hook underneath them, pick up just a little bit, because they are, you know, I mean, they can be a little unpredictable when it's feeding time, because, you know, to them, that smell is very, very, triggering. You know what I mean? It just wakes them, that part of them up. And so, you know, they can kind of get unpredictable, but as long as you watch, to make sure they're not in a, like a position to strike you. And then you slide the hook underneath them, lift them up just a little bit. You know, like I said, I grab at least one part of them. And the second I start pulling them up off the ground or off the tub or wherever I have them in, they basically just kind of go into like grab onto me. I'm being lifted up mode. You know what I mean? It's no longer a time of feeding. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, so it's like the switch gets flipped off and then they're like, okay, we're being picked up. And obviously that would be a learned behavior as well. They know once that sensation's happening, the mealtime is over. And I think that's a good point for people. And I think just in general, this is one of those conversations that I think gives people hope that they could have a much tighter bond with their snake or even lizard than they have at this time. Oh, are those some raccoon prints?
Yeah. Yeah.
See, they're following you. But you know, like,
continue.
Yeah, just hearing your story and your ability to connect with your animals. I know there are so many people that a lot of people who listen to the podcast only have two or three animals, and that's kind of the way they like it. Or maybe they only have one. I know there's a lot of people that listen to the show that just have a single animal, which I love to hear those stories, and they want to have that bond with their animal. But at the same time, you always hear the, you know, your animal will, they will interact with you, but they don't like to interact with you and so on and so on. And of course there are elements of that if you have not exposed them to you properly. But I think you are proof that they're not, like you said, they're not going to see you like a dog sees you, but they're going to see you as, okay, this is the human force in their life that allows them to get out and exercise and do other things. And they associate you with positive energy and positive experiences. And that's a 100% not an unscientific thing to say. And it's 100% something that's on the table for everybody who keeps a snake.
Right. Well, and here's the thing, dude, is that sometimes people will accuse me of using scent to lure out the snakes. Like in some of those videos where I put my hand in there and Mojo crawls up my arm or whatever. But first off, I would never recommend using scent, food scent, to try to lure your snake, because you're asking to get bit, you know, onto your arm, right? Like if I were to take a rat and rub a dead rat up my arm to try to get him to go up my arm, that would be a terrible, terrible idea. I would not ever recommend it. Second off, even if I did do that, his body language would be completely different, right? He would totally be tense. His neck would be S'd up. He'd be flicking his tongue really rapidly. You know, you would see the body language of predation, right? Or that predator mode, rather. And so, you know, that's one thing to keep in consideration, is that I'm not using food to motivate these animals, right? It's literally just me interacting with them. When I'm talking about the snakes, of course, I'm not using food to interact with them. They don't get any treats. They don't, you know, I'm not doing target training or anything like that, which I don't have anything against, but I just don't do that, right? And so, you know, there's several factors in that. The fact that you got to, when you're forming a bond, you know, you obviously, like with some animals, like your dog or your cat, like offering them treats, or like with the raccoons, like offering them treats is a great way to, build that bond faster. But with a snake, I can't do that. Right. So really what I am offering them, as far as what are they getting out of it? They're getting interaction. They're getting, you know, stimulation. I'm taking them out of the enclosure, you know, putting them somewhere else, you know, and they're getting that interaction with that's not their enclosure. Another thing, too, is that I think that we as people, or as a culture, we like to assume the consciousness or the level of intelligence that animals have. And going back to the fish thing, and, you know, whatever, people thought that, you know, these animals are dumb, had no memory, you know, whatever. And now we're talking about snakes, and, you know, so many people think that they can't bond with a human being. You know, that so many people think that you can't even cohab them without them ripping each other apart. Right. But what I'm kind of trying to show is that there's a different element to them, right? Like there's something a little deeper. Now, I'm not going to say that, you know, snakes are going to start writing poetry or tax code or tell you what the meaning of irony is, but there's certainly an intelligence and the ability to learn, right? If they can learn that I'm not a threat and then trust me, that actually tells me a lot. Because I mean, think about it from a wild animal standpoint, which is basically what a baby boa constrictor is, or a baby Brazilian rainbow boa. It's essentially a wild animal, right? Like it's not like bringing home a puppy, And so when you first start interacting with that baby snake, you have to build the trust right away and let them know that you're not a threat, right? And so the ability for them to learn that such a large creature is not a threat, you know what I mean? And then to be able to trust or at least be able to be comfortable with, it says a lot. You know what I mean? That tells me a lot about their abilities to learn, their cognition, sentience, stuff like that. I mean, because if you think about it from a survival standpoint, what small snake is going to crawl on the top of an animal that is 1,000 times its size?
Yeah. Willingly.
You know what I mean? Right. And I get, that's another thing I get too, is that, oh, it's just crawling on you because it thinks you're a warm treat. It thinks I'm a warm tree. I've gotten that before. And it's like, okay, so you're telling me that snake's crawling on me and its sense of smell can't detect my heat, or I can't detect my odors. Its heat pits can't detect my heat, nor its body detect my heat from touching me. And it can't feel my heartbeat or my breathing. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't know that I'm a living thing. I don't think that's the case. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. never have I ever seen, a garden snake crawl on top of my dog to get warm.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, my dog will lay outside in the grass, and I've never seen a garter snake crawl on top of it to, you know, thermal regulate. I've just never seen it. So there's more of an element of, I don't know what I know I say bonding a lot, but it's like a relationship, right? Like, there's an element of they are seeking, right? Like, they're seeking me. Like, when I stick my hand in there, Mojo crawls onto me. He's making the choice to do that, right? Like, yeah. I'm not pulling out of the cage and saying, hey, we're going outside today. I'm putting my hand in there, and if he wants to come out, he comes out. And there are times where they don't. Right? Like, I'll stick my hand in there and they don't want to come out. But that's also kind of goes to, you know, them being an individual, and, you know, individuals have preferences at certain times, you know, like right now, exactly. I don't want to go to work, so I'm not going to go, you know, but it's the same, you know, it's the same kind of idea. You know, they do things on their terms. And as long as I respect that, and I give them the opportunity to make that choice, then I'm giving them the best opportunity that they can have. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
totally.
As far as a relationship or some sort of a bond, you know what I mean? Like, that's really the only kind of indicators you can have of it. You really can't have a situation where I'm pulling the snake out of the enclosure and then I say, hey, look, he's bonded to me. He loves me. Well, how do I know that? You just pulled him out. Right.
Yeah.
Well, like, if I went up to a dog go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, I think it's very clear that they clearly relate you to some positive experience. So whether the experience is actually interacting with you, or the experience is something further than that, like maybe the freedom of getting out of the enclosure, they know that you're linked with that in some capacity, or that you're linked with potentially getting to go outside, or even linked with food. There are so many different ways that they've linked you to a positive experience. Like I said, whether they see you as the positive experience or they see you as the pathway to the positive experience, it's still causing a bond between you and them. And I think that's really beneficial. And just as you're talking, it makes me think of, you know, if you take a domesticated animal, like a dog or a cat, they come out of the box totally fine with humans, and they actually need to learn that humans are a danger. And that's where you get into the stress animals or the strays and the feral animals, right? Those ones learn to eventually be afraid of humans. When we're dealing with reptiles and non-domesticated animals, it's the opposite. Like, they come out of the box being afraid of humans, and they have to learn that humans right. aren't always danger, a danger to their well-being or their life. And I think that's exactly what you've highlighted here.
Right. No, totally. And you're 100% right, because when they're born, their instincts are telling them that large creatures are going to hurt them.
Yeah.
Right. And that's actually pretty across the board for just about any kind of animal, because, I mean, I think we, think a lot of times people, we forget our perspective because we only see one perspective, but we're big compared to a lot of creatures, right? Like my raccoon friends, like if I stand up too fast, like they get scared because I'm a big, scary animal, right? But, you know, we don't really, we forget that sometimes when we're dealing with these creatures. And so if we put ourselves in the perspective from them, or from their perspective rather, that, you know, we're basically a giant. We're reaching our big hand in there and we're grabbing them out and we're looking at them with our big dumb face. Like that's scary to them. You know what I mean?
Totally.
They're terrified. And so when they hiss or puff up, or they do defensive strikes, it makes sense. You know what I mean? I don't hold it against them. And when I've been bit before by snakes a lot of times. In fact, my snakes have bit me. Orion's got me once. And Mojo's gotten me 3 times, but it's all been defensive. It's all been my fault because I reached too fast or I did something stupid. You know what I mean? And it never hurts. Not, you know, people get this idea that, like, you get bit by a snake. Oh my God, I was bit by a snake. It's really a psychological thing. Actually, it's more scary that a snake bit you than it actually hurts.
Yeah.
I've been bit by dogs, and I'll tell you right now, I would way rather get bit by a big snake than even a medium dog. Like,
oh yeah,
it's not even a comparable. You know what I mean? A dog's got a serious bite force, especially if they shake. Oh, you're done. That's some damaged tissue.
Yeah, absolutely. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean,
I think you're so right, and it's a really a fascinating element to reptile keeping, and I think it's one that is lacking for a lot of reasons. Just, you know, we're not dealing with domesticated animals. So there's a different process that you have to use to create these relationships. But I think you're doing a great job just highlighting those relationships and how the bond can actually happen. And, you know, you're not using any smoke and mirrors. These are the bonds. You know, like you said, people in the comments are thinking that you're using different tactics to make these animals do what they do. I know that's not true. And I think many of the listeners will also realize that as well when they see it. Rex, it's always fascinating to chat with you, and I think your perspective about reptile keeping and just life in general is fascinating. Is there anything that we didn't mention today that you wanted to make sure we cover before we wrap up?
You know, I did kind of actually want to talk about the rules that I have for cohabbing, if you don't mind.
Please, please. Yeah, let's go through those.
Okay. Yeah, so when it comes to cohabbing, like I said, I've been doing it for years and years, since I was about 12 years old. Actually maybe a little earlier than that, probably about 10 or 11. But, so I learned from my stepdad, and he learned it from the guy that taught him. And so I kind of have that as like a base, right? And one of the things, or I should say all of the things that he, instilled in me, it's all common sense. When I start lifting this stuff off, it all makes sense, right? Number one, you never feed them on the same day. Or I'm sorry, you never feed them in the same enclosure on different days. You always feed them outside of the enclosure, always on the same day. I mean, that's pretty no-brainer, right? I wouldn't throw one rat in with four snakes, right?
Exactly.
Another thing is sizes, right? I'm not going to have an anaconda with a children's python. That's gonna be a crushed children's python at some point, right? You wouldn't want to have a python and boas together, or boas and anacondas together anyway. But the point being, you want to stick with the similar sized creatures, right?
Yeah.
So Burmese pythons, similar sized Burmese pythons. If you're talking about red-tailed boas, similar sized red-tailed boas. I don't want to have a size discrepancy where one is so big and one is so small that you have to worry about one getting crushed or injured. Another thing is obviously, and I know I touched on this before, is having similar environment, right? Like you're not going to take a desert animal and put it into a jungle environment or the reverse, because you're going to have all sorts of problems, with health issues, right? Like if it's a desert environment and you're putting an animal that, is evolved to be in high humidity, that animal's going to suffer and suffer badly. And so that, you know, obviously that's common sense as well. You want to make sure that the animals are healthy, right? So I'm not going to take a sick animal or one that I'm worried about its health or its you know, is it diseased or whatever. I want to make sure all the animals that I'm putting together are 100% healthy. And if there's any issues, quarantine, separate them, right? Until they are healthy. I'm kind of drawing a blank here. I guess I'm stuck upon that one. Watching for stress, watching for behaviors. That's going to be a huge one, is when you put these animals together, you have to keep an eye on them and see how they're interacting. You can't just toss them in and then walk away and hope that they're going to be fine. That's not going to work. Another one is, and I know we talked about this before, is enclosure size, right? You're not going to want to house four large snakes in a medium enclosure. That's not going to be good for anybody, right? I touched on feeding. Making sure that you got enough space too. So like one hide that would fit one snake is okay. But if all those snakes are trying to shove themselves underneath that one hide, it's going to make, you know, it's going to make kind of chaos. So I offer like bigger hides so that multiple snakes can hide under there, as well as a large water bowl. So that way, if multiple snakes want to lay in the water bowl, they can. Like I said before, my hog islands never soak, but my Brazilians often do. And they a lot of times soak together. So I make sure that I have a big enough bowl that if for some reason all of them wanted to climb in, I'm not going to have a bunch of water coming out, or, you know, certain snakes not going to be able to fit. I would actually, believe it or not, I would like to add some kind of a pond or water feature at some point, but I'm just not sure how I'd go about doing that, just because I know my boys would use it as a toilet at some point.
Yeah.
their primary toilet, I should say. And then that brings me to the next point, is cleanliness. So, you know, obviously with one snake, you want to make sure that you're picking up the poop, but it's even more important when you got multiple snakes, because I don't want them crawling around in each other's poop. Right. So I pick up all the fecal matter as soon as I see it. And I always stay on top and, you know, look for it every day, pick up urates. I change out the bedding once a year. I pull all of it out, put all fresh, new bedding in, clean everything really well. Some people, and this is another thing too, and this is not necessarily related to cohab, but I feel like some people are over sanitizing their enclosures. Like I've seen people talk about how they pull everything out and they sanitize everything. And I mean, you know, I guess if you got a quarantine situation, but look around me, what here is sanitary?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like where's the rubbing alcohol out here?
Yeah.
You know? I mean, there's bacteria and fungi. That's part of life. That's part of nature. Yes, we want to make sure that we're not introducing or having negative fungi or bacterial infections that could cause problems. But at the same time, I really think that over sanitizing is not only a waste of time, money, and resources, but also you're creating a situation where the animal's not exposed enough, and it might have an issue with a improper immune system function.
Yeah. We talked about this.
You sanitizer all the time or.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, I mean, go ahead.
We talked we had somebody on a couple, I guess months ago now. And, he was talking about in the fish industry, he worked in a fish store and they would constantly get these fish from big time breeders that would just totally like basically raise their fish fry in like an antibiotic soup. So the fish wouldn't get sick when they're at the breeder because they were constantly being exposed to antibiotics. And then as soon as they came to the fish store, they would just die because they were being exposed to even simple pathogens that theoretically their immune system should have no issue with. So yeah, I think you're right. There's no, it's not a call to have a messy and filthy environment. It's just a call to say, hey, maybe we don't need to take everything out and sterilizing it. Like spot cleaning an area, pulling out that dirty substrate and replacing it with fresh substrate really is almost all you need to be doing. Maybe once a year, like you said, doing a full fresh clean, but you don't need to be taking everything out and wiping it down with bleach all the time.
Right. I don't even use bleach. I use hydrogen peroxide. I use rubbing alcohol. Mostly I use rubbing alcohol on glass, as far as a glass cleaner. I use hydrogen peroxide mostly and vinegar. I don't like bleach because it's not good for the animal. I really don't like using bleach at all, in general. But I actually, believe it or not, I don't even wipe down my branches unless for some reason one of the snakes pooped on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I just don't feel that all the sanitation is necessary. And I'm sure I'm going to get hate for it, but that's fine.
No, I mean, I totally agree. I'm very similar with that. I'm not over sanitizing. And I've actually started using hydrogen peroxide as well. Hydrogen peroxide diluted in water as well as chlorhexidine, which are both like relatively, they're chemicals that are not harsh on the animal's eyes or their skin, but they are also good at killing bacteria and whatnot. So, I mean, of course, bleach has its place if you're dealing with a quarantine situation where you're needing to, actually sanitize and sterilize an environment, but that's not what we're talking about here. So, yeah, I think it's a great point.
Right. Yeah, and another thing too, and going back to the cohabbing thing, is obviously if you're dealing with certain types of creatures, you know what I mean? Like, you don't want to introduce prey, right? Like, you don't want to, if you got a king snake, you're not going to try and cohab it with a garter snake, right? Yeah. Like, no ophiophagic snakes in, oh shit, the battery here, hold on, can you still hear me?
Yep, I can still hear you. Yeah,
you want? Okay, sorry. Yeah, my phone's running out of battery.
Oh no, that's all good. Yeah, yeah, we'll wrap it up right away.
Snake eating snakes is definitely not something that you want to cohab. But I mean, as long as you follow some of these like very simple common sense rules, you know, enclosure size, animal size, feeding on the same day, not feeding in the enclosure, making sure you offer multiple hides, multiple things for them to engage with and do, so they're not huddled together all the time, right? You don't want a bear enclosure. You don't want something where they don't have anything to interact with. As long as you're following all this stuff, I've never had any issues. You know, I've been doing this most of my life, since I was like 10 or 11. And I have not had any issues. Now, again, I've seen other people have issues, but they had issues because they broke the rule. They didn't follow, the guidelines. So, it's not for everybody. It's really not. And the thing is, there's nothing that says you have to do anything. You know what I mean? If you're not comfortable doing it, don't do it. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But if you are, if you feel that you know your animals well enough and you feel that you can hit those points, I mean, there's really nothing that says that you can't.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know.
Well, I think that's a perfect way to wrap up. I mean, kind of giving those concise points for people that want to experiment with this and give it a shot. I think you laid out the rules that are going to give you success, provided you follow those rules and you're paying attention and are intently following your animals. I think there's no reason that people can't experiment with this within their own collection. And Rex, this was a fantastic conversation. I want to make sure we wrap up before your phone dies. I always love chatting with you because the relationship and the perspective you have with your animals, I think is something that is super important and not enough people talk about, because I think people are afraid to talk about it because they're afraid that they're not going to sound scientific in a scientific world. And I think it's so important to have these conversations, because I know there are people who are listening who feel like they have these bonds with their animals, but are too embarrassed to talk about it. And because they think it's like in their own head. So I want to thank you for coming on the podcast, and please tell everybody where they can find you on social media.
I'm on TikTok. It's Rex Calubra, at Rex Calubra. I've also got a page just for Elvis. It's at Elvis the Smallmouth. And then on Instagram, it's just at the All Animal Channel, where you can look up my name.
Okay, perfect. I will make sure that's all in the show notes for people. And until we do the next one, Rex, this was fantastic. So thank you very much for being a guest on the podcast again.
Hey, this was awesome. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. All right, that is the end of that episode. thank you so much for tuning in, everyone. I do really appreciate it. Again, episode number 200. It's been an amazing ride. So thank you all for continuing to support the show. If you want to check out CustomReptileHabitats.com, you can do that in the affiliate link in YouTube, on the YouTube description or the show notes. If you do make a purchase, a commission comes back to me at no extra cost to you. You can also head out to patreon.com/animalsathome if you want to support the podcast that way. A big thanks to Rex for joining me on the podcast today. I had a blast chatting with you, and it's definitely a different scenery seeing somebody walk through the forest and record the podcast. And I think that was an interesting and unique perspective, and just your perspective about animal keeping and interacting with animals is very valuable. And I do really appreciate you sharing your story today. And again, whether this is the 200th episode you've listened to or the first episode you've listened to, thank you so much. If you want to help support the podcast, just share it on social media. Can we do another 200 episodes? I think so. I don't know for sure. I mean, 6 years was a long time. I do feel like I still have many more episodes to go. What the future will hold, I don't know. But if you are enjoying the podcast and you want it to keep going, find a way to support it, whether it's just sharing on social media, leaving a comment, checking out the Patreon, checking out the show sponsors. Any of those things really do help and make go a long way to continuing the Animals at Home podcast into the future. I will catch you guys in the next episode.